all I wanted on that show, like my first step, I was fully immersed in that world and just like, I'm lucky to be here, right? Just do it. But was really feeling uncomfortable and was really feeling uncomfortable with that fetishization of violence on really what I was noticing. It's like on people of color in these films.
Welcome to another episode of Not Invisible, Native Peoples on the Front Lines. I'm your host, Leandra Neffin. Today's guest is filmmaker and host of the Aunties Dandelion podcast, Paulette Moore. The Aunties Dandelion is a group of strong Indigenous women who have created an amazing space to share, listen, and receive so much love during a time in which we are all in great need of finding places to heal, to laugh, and to grow. Thank you for joining us. Welcome, Paulette.
What Kwanawanadu say Wakwego, Gasta Saraguate, Yangyats, Ganyagehaga, Ni Wakwinjoda, Oswego, Nidawageno, Danu Wehikovne, Danu Oswego, Tkidiru Nuwa, Danu Wagenatu. So my name is Gasta Saraguate, Paulette Moore. My name means bright feather in Mohawk. So I'm a Mohawk person enrolled at Six Nations of the Grand River, which is near Toronto. It's about an hour and a half southwest of Toronto. And I am Turtle Clan, and I live in Six Nations and also here in Isleta Pueblo. So that's a really nice migration circle, you know, to be going back and forth. And grew up in Niagara Falls. My grandfather grew up at Six Nations. My mother did not. And I don't know if you know, you probably know that a lot of Mohawk men are iron workers and like built New York City and, you know, those pictures of people sitting on the...
famous, iconic photo.
That was my grandfather and my uncle Art and my cousin. Is still an iron worker. So we have that tradition in our family and grew up in Niagara Falls and then went to Washington, D.C., always just loved storytelling. And really that was from my uncle is an extraordinary storyteller and very simple. Like he loves to just talk about being an iron worker or walking in the woods and catching a raccoon. But I noted from a really young age how compelling his stories were. I was just so in love with that storytelling and how it made me feel. And so I really started noticing how people tell stories and wanted to do that for my career and became like a local news reporter. And, you know, like with your stand up and I ended up in Washington, D.C. and was a reporter there. In my first jobs in Washington, so very mainstream media reporter for a long time, an economic news reporter with Westinghouse Television. And then I moved into I went to Japan for a year and was a reporter there. And that was really fun because it was a joint project between NHK, which is Japan's public broadcaster, and PBS here on the US side and a particular Seattle station. And so I was reporting from Japan, you know, and that was in my late 20s. And that was so much fun and became more visual. When I started out, it was really hard news and I considered myself a news junkie, you know, and I really felt like there was power in that because we grew up without resources. We grew up with, you know, no connections, no money, you know, in my mind, you know. And so I really thought that like, if I were to like get power, it would be good for me to be where the power seems to live. And that seemed to be Washington, D.C. So when, you know, spent time in D.C., then went to Japan. And when I was coming back to D.C. from Japan is when Discovery Channel was taking off. And I started working with them very early on doing a long form documentary. So going from news, very short, you know, with me in front of the camera And then moving to longer pieces when I was in Japan, and they had to be really visual because of the language barrier, right? Like they all had to just, and I was like, wait, this visual side is so expanding, you know, it's expanding what I do. And then to come back and start working with Geographic, and then Discovery first, and then Geographic came into that long form, not the specials, but the cable channel that came in later, like in early 2000s. So started working with all of that group, the mainstream media, and then got into independent films because really I was not seeing my community, Indigenous people. I wasn't seeing women. All of my shows were about the military, about, you know, there's this show called Wings on Discovery Channel, where it's all about military airplanes. It's super fun to film, you know, really exciting. But these stories are always about war and planes and weapons of war. And then we moved into an era when I was doing just like police shows, you know, and I was like the police show expert. But that was just making me physically ill, honestly. And then moved into independent productions, did a lot of films where Indigenous people were standing up on the front lines, like in northern Wisconsin. The Ojibwe led this beautiful, successful pushback against what would have been the world's largest open pit mine, and based around food sovereignty. So, and I was really noticing that mainstream media was not covering these really. I'm like, I'm from mainstream media. This is a story, man. This is like the world's biggest open pit mine on the shores of 10% of the world's fresh water, the world's largest wild rice bed. You know, I know what a story is. You have to work really hard to ignore that as a story. So that's what I really did start to notice. And so then Standing Rock happened. So I made two major films up there with the Ojibwe. And there was so much ceremony that was going on there to push back against that mine. That was the key. And anyone you ask up there will say it is this education aspect that they had, which was so powerful, like giving people the tools to harvest maple syrup. You know, like, hey, look, there's a wild onion. I'm going to pick it up and eat it right now. Guess what? I'm connected to the land. So brilliant, brilliant strategy. And all of the Ojibwe up there in northern Wisconsin are just, they're all educators. They're just so amazing. And so I just learned so much about protest. But, you know, I loved at Standing Rock that it was protection. You know, it was protection and then education. So then when Standing Rock hit, I was like, I'm really ready to access this story and be in service to this story from this perspective of ceremony and from this perspective of strength of our people. And I think that this is what your work focuses on a lot, right? These narratives that have been so destructive to us. And I did see people out at Standing Rock, these major platforms, yeah, they did show up, but they were like, where's the feathers? Where's the trauma? Where's talk? You know, like literally cannot hear that Ongwehome people are leading and just like listen, you know? So those were really formative, important experiences for me. And then made my way back to Six Nations. I hadn't lived on Six Nations until I was in my early 50s. And so moved back, and I've been in language for the last, well, really 10 years, but like in immersion for the last 3 years, graduated actually last May in Mohawk language immersion. So was able to remember my language, be back in my community, and then start this organization called the Aunties Dandelion that is all about these narratives of land and language and relationships. So that's where we are now.
Wow. Your story is just amazing, like, and so inspirational too, because you think about that representation in media and journalism. I mean, these are really important roles that our people, you know, really need to be occupying. And I guess it makes me think about our youth coming up, you know, and kind of what advice you would give to Native youth that want to come up and do documentary filmmaking, because we are seeing that. We're seeing emergence of that, aren't we, with like Reservation Dogs and Sterling Harjo and, you know, these kind of really they're starting to kind of hit mainstream and they're popular. But, you know, you were kind of in that kind of journalism world as well, almost kind of straddling these two, you know, worlds in terms of documentary filmmaking and journalism. But what advice would you give to our Native youth that wants to kind of get into the same thing that you're doing and in some of that filmmaking and journalism work?
I think that it's really important for people getting into the business now to really understand that they need to stay grounded. And I really just realized more and more, like, that word is so important because we're land-based people, you know? So staying grounded, not just being a diversity hire, like an Indigenous person that's filled in a slot, but someone who is bringing the beauty and the importance of our communities, especially in this world of chaos that we're living in. I really do believe all of our Ongwehengwe communities have a worldview and philosophy that is missing, and that if the mainstream, I call it the overculture, could just listen just a little bit, you know, to the strength and the expansiveness, you know, that exists in our way of viewing the world, then, and bringing that to the narrative. And I have to tell you, that is not easy. I'm not saying something that's easy, because as someone who was completely invested, I really wasn't straddling two worlds in DC. I was fully over on the overcultural side, you know? And when I look at, I teach like indigenizing media, or, mm-hmm. you know, how to bring ourselves into this dialogue. And it was so hard for me because stories are told in a really particular way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have some video from the very first day of the first Iraq war, where I'm in DC and I'm like in front of the Capitol, and I'm like rat-a-tat-a-tat-a, you know how they speak in that, really, that's not the way I speak, but you know, I'm like,
yeah,
you know, and I'm like 26, you know, but I'm acting like I know what I'm talking about. And it's planes taking off, and I edited the whole thing. It's like planes taking off. It's like all these like war images, Wall Street, yay, Wall Street's cheering. This is a story that I did on the first day of a war, right? And then fast forward 30 years later to Standing Rock. And then I had this other clip of interviewing the drone pilot, Dean Deadman, who really made big, that was just hugely experimental with the drones out there at Standing Rock. And just how my own style has changed of listening to Dean. It's not my face that's on. I'm not rat-a-tat, you know, doing the bullet pointed story. I'm asking Dean, because the pipeline was coming through right over. He's from Standing Rock. So he was standing there, and there was a no-fly zone after one of the big evictions. And he was just, I was there with him as he was looking at the footage, the first time he had flown for a number of days, and he was heartbroken. And so we're showing his drone footage, and I'm interviewing him, and it's just a whole different pace. It's a whole different aesthetic. It's a whole different way. And what my goal is when I'm with our Ongwehengwe people in these protection actions, or no matter what the story is, it's I want our people to see themselves adored. You know, I put the camera low and look up to, you know, it involves the aesthetics, but it also involves the intention of what you want to bring to the story. And still mainstream media is so, it's so hard for them to understand it. And in this recent interview that I did with Paige Bethman, who's a Mohawk Oneida filmmaker, she had that same experience. She was at Vox for a number of years, and brought story after story after story, super compelling. And they're like, oh, you know what? I don't know what the stakes are about, like, residential schools, right? And I was like, oh, that, I know what that is about. I had that same experience. And all these years later, it's really the same. So as far as continuing on that advice, stay grounded. Reservation Dogs does an amazing job of bringing that joy and humor and wisdom in our communities in a way that isn't, like, you know, preachy or pedantic in any way. So look at what's really happening with Reservation Dogs is what I would say to the youngsters coming in. And why is that such a compelling? Because these are complex stories. It's not just fetishizing poverty in our communities, you know, but really it's about the resilience of, and just the pushback to a culture, but all put in story. We're all, it's just like so many beautiful storytellers, you know, which is why I love doing the podcast, because I'm like, our people are just philosophers and storytellers and have a take on, have something to say, you know. And just one more thing, like, I'm part of this Banff, it's called the Spark Accelerator for women media owners, media company owners. And, you know, it's really exciting. We're going to have, you know, time to pitch, and, you know, we make a cohort, and that's really useful. And what I noticed from some of the speakers that are coming in, I've been out of mainstream media for a long time. I still have a lot of those contacts, but they're still talking just about murder hornets. You know, like, they're just like, the amount of money that is spent on these stories that are super fun. Like, I'm probably most famous for a show called El Chupacabras is what the show is called, about the chupacabra, right? Mm-hmm. And we spent so much money on that show. It was so much fun. That was for Geographic. It got promoted. It's still out there. I met people in Switzerland that were like, you did the Chupacabra show? And they were quoting lines from the show and stuff. And at the end of the day, it's like, what has this done for our communities? It's so many resources. I'm glad I got to learn storytelling in that way, in a mainstream vibe. And how is it that, like, we have something to say, again, not in a pedantic way. We have great, beautiful stories in our communities that need to be accessed, not just through the trauma of, I don't want to be I'm not avoiding the issues, the important issues. I don't want to trigger all of our community members when I make sad stories about, like, drunk people, you know. Like, that's not what I see.
Yeah. And I guess that's kind of, you know, one of the things, I suppose, that, you know, distance kind of affords you as well. You know, you're able to really see the beauty in, you know, our communities, and see the beauty in our people and our cultural ways. And, you know, for me, I can understand that pushback, particularly because, you know, I work in a field that is based on Western science, you know, psychology, and is incredibly marginalizing and, you know, has been historically to people of color. And, you know, for me, I'm currently doing my research on fostering culturally competent therapists. And it's, you know, it's a topic that I think a lot of people get a little bit reticent about, because when you talk about race and ethnicity and culture, people are afraid to talk about those things, particularly as a therapist. How do you bring that up in the therapy room? And so I think in a lot of the fields that natives occupy, our worldview is colored by our connection to land, our oral traditions, our ways of learning. You know, and when you talk about that connection to land, it just kind of reminded me of, you know, growing up with my dad. He was a hunter. He's known as, you know, a really good hunter on my community. And, you know, we grew up hunting and fishing and living off the lands. And he would tell us stories, you know, and at the time when you're a kid, as you're kind of walking through the forest, going, you know, looking for mushrooms, we would specifically hunt morel mushrooms. when they were in season. We used to love and look forward to hunting for that. Mm-hmm. He would tell us stories, you know. He would say, okay, make sure you walk gently. Be very, very quiet because the mushrooms will disappear. You won't find them. They'll only present themselves to you if you walk gently and if you come in a humble way and you look for them and you're sensitive about how you're looking for them. Because we would be, you know, walking through the forest, stomping on everything and jumping in every puddle or whatever it was. And so we took this really serious, like, oh, okay, we've got to walk gently. We've got to tiptoe through the forest. And notoriously, we would get the biggest mushrooms of our community. I mean, my dad was in the local newspaper and everything, like these huge morel mushrooms that he would fry up in his famous beer batter recipes and everything. And when I was like, and this is no joke, when I was 15, I was like 13, 14, like teenage years, he was talking to a friend of his about, you know, oh, it's mushroom hunting season. Are you going to come out with us? And I made the comment, yeah, but you need to be quiet because they'll disappear. Like, I really believe this story. And even into like teenage years. And his friend just kind of looked at me like I was just completely crazy. And I thought at that time, I was so embarrassed. And I asked my dad about it later. He's no, I just said that to you as a joke. But having said that, there is an actual story in our tribe about walking gently so that the mushroom don't disappear from you. But it's like things like that. When you think about an indigenous kind of worldview, you sort of think, you know, these stories, they actually teach us broader issues in terms of reciprocity. We learned that reciprocal exchange in how what we take, we also give back, you know, so we would leave things, you know, but the way that we would learn that was through story. But it wasn't until I was much older, kind of reflecting back on it, that it started to kind of slot in and all make sense. And so I think as Indigenous people, we always kind of bring that to the table. And that's an important perspective in terms of, you know, media, in terms of therapy, in terms of filmmaking. You know, these are all really important perspectives that deserve to be heard and to be seen and to be known. This is actually a difficult thing. And I think a lot of people probably struggle, and I'm sure you can probably understand in terms of being in academia, is I feel like there's these kind of compartmentalized parts of my life, right? So I work as a full-time complex trauma therapist, my professional life, you know, there's this kind of plate spinning. And then I'm a university student studying for my master's. So I've got that plate spinning. And then there's this kind of advocacy, activism work, and, you know, where my passion really lies. And so I'm constantly trying to merge these things into one. And I'm hoping that with my PhD, that might actually happen, but it's starting to kind of come together. So elements of my trauma work, I guess, inform my understanding, you know, around MMIW or MMIWP or MMIWR and MMIWG2ST, you know, all these kind of, you know, layers that encompass missing and murdered Indigenous relatives. You know, these all are born out of colonization, out of trauma, intergenerational trauma, residential boarding schools. So all of these pieces of the puzzle come together in terms of my understanding, but I'd like to do more work where I can actually merge all three of my kind of projects that I'm involved with, you know, work, academic, activism work. And hopefully I might be able to do that with my PhD is what I'm hoping.
Mm-hmm. It seems like it's all touching.
It's starting to line up, but yeah. I mean, you must struggle with the same. I mean, with academia, how did you kind of, you know, navigate where you were coming? Because I know you mentioned that you were sort of all the way over the line. And then how did you kind of start to, you know, I know you mentioned Standing Rock, but how do you kind of balance those two, you know, those things?
I would say that I got called back, you know, to my own community really specifically and incrementally, but notably. And the journey from being in mainstream media in DC to where I am now, like with the Auntie Sandy Lion and the stories that we're telling with the podcast and with the films, it couldn't just happen all at once. So this would be part of advice that I would give to people is that, you know, it's, you're so steeped in that environment, and who the heck does not want to work for National Geographic, right? Like, that's what I really wanted to do. And I ended up there, and it was heartbreaking, honestly. And I was describing one show that I worked on there where it was about Indigenous people in the Amazon. And all I wanted on that show, you know, I was feeling all this like, what? And it was very white savior dude who goes into the Amazon, and he's the dude in that backdrop. And I actually had somebody say that on a different show, like, the show isn't about the Indigenous people, the show is about the host, you know, on a different show. So that mindset is very much there, that Indigenous people are backdrops to you know, mainstream tall white dude hosts, you know. To make that broad strokes, you know, but all I wanted on that show, like my first step, I was fully immersed in that world and just like, I'm lucky to be here, right? Just do it. But was really feeling uncomfortable, and was really feeling uncomfortable with that fetishization of violence on really what I was noticing. It's like on people of color in these films, the cop shows were fetishizing the violence. And I watched somebody bleed out in an alley in Baltimore on the Southern show. And that really, really got to me, because it was like, what the heck? What the heck am I doing here? And so on that Geographic show that I was talking about in the Amazon, I said to the executive producers, can we just have a different voice? They really wanted that British voice of, you know, authority overlaid on the show. And oh my gosh, there was no reason given. I was like, can we even just start with a British woman? You know, just because I was like, once we start to change one aesthetic, maybe we can start to change other things. And they were like, no, it was just unequivocally no. And so I would say that was such a huge turning point for me of what I'm bringing to my own communities by depicting the white savior dude and then these beautiful people, you know, in the Amazon that are just unequivocally stated as the props to, you know, to this guy that we were featuring. You know, you're young and you're, you know, in those spaces that you've always wanted to be in, and then climbing down that corporate ladder is a whole other thing. So, you know, if you're just getting into the media business, just find your grounding now, because that incremental, it's just been piece by piece. And I've been so unsure of myself for a really long time about what does it look like? Like, do I smudge my camera? Like, what does it mean? You know, what does it look like? And I actually had this Ojibwe woman that was, you know, you don't want to be like, oh, I'm smudging my camera, you know, like it's like artifice or something. And this Ojibwe woman said, no. Yeah, you should be smudging your camera, because those are the rock beings that are telling your story. And I was like, okay, like I've been humbled, you know, because I'm like, oh, I don't want to be that person that's, you know, and she's like, no. She took it really, really seriously. Smudge the rock beings. So finding you have, and I've been, you know, I've relied on philosophers like the work of Robin Wall Kimmerer and what she went through to get her PhD, because she's like, why are these flowers so beautiful together? Basically, that was like kind of the foundation of her thesis as a scientist. And, you know, her advisors were like, go somewhere else, go to art school. You know, that's not what we're doing here. And then Brian Burkhart from University of Oklahoma, that talks about indigenizing philosophy through the land. And what I love about him is he is so strong. He's like, here's what we're not going to do. Like right in the beginning, he's like, you're not gonna ask me to work 18 times as hard as Rene Descartes, you know, to get my point across. I'm not gonna, you know, and this is what I find in my own studies is like, oh, well, that's cute, but you just, you know, that's not really a thing, you know. So Brian Burkhart, and then the work of Sherry Mitchell as well, who is, she's a lawyer and just does beautiful work on original instructions and that intuition that comes up that we need to discuss and talk about how that plays out in our work. So, you know, backing out of something that I was so dedicated to was twice as hard, because when you're like, yeah, because, you know, it's the great undoing. And then for a long time, not knowing what's the replacement. And I did even think of leaving media because it was so hard, because I made those shows one after another, like 30 hour long documentaries, you know, and countless news stories. And those, when you start to deconstruct those, there is such a pattern and a way of telling a story that is just like air, you know, and starting to tell people that's not air, you know, that's not the authority that I'm working from, and really having to lose what look like opportunities, but will only be just a really painful experience for everyone involved. You know, it's like, so what's that line where you're educating or infiltrating, you know, a mainstream organization in order to just start to have a conversation. So it's like, how much capacity do you have? How much time do you have? I think those are the choices that we're constantly making as Indigenous people.
Yeah, absolutely. Trying to find the equipoise in the chaos, you know, in terms of navigating those spaces that can be really difficult. And
where are you getting your PhD?
I haven't applied yet because I'm doing my master's at the moment.
Okay.
Master's at the University of Oxford. But after this master's, I've made the decision to take some time off. I was originally going to go straight into my PhD, but mm-hmm. I've kind of decided I just need to rest, you know, from academia for a little bit. So that will probably be a kind of a future project. But yeah, it's something that I'm kind of debating between going into continuing on the lines of, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, or I'm looking at another university. A really great institution, University of Kent, that has a Center for Indigenous and Settler Colonial Studies. Yeah, it's really amazing. Uh-huh. And I've kind of made connections with them and thought about doing kind of, you know, more of an autoethnography dissertation about my life, you know, living here in, as an Indigenous woman in the United Kingdom, in the colonial empire, trying to forge a way, you know, through the heartland of empire.
I know. I just think that, you know, when you were talking about it right at the beginning, I was like, when's that book coming out? For that documentary film, you know?
Right, right. Watch this space, you know, maybe 10 years from now, because, you know, I need to just take that break. And, you know, it's just really hard. You know, I think as you were even kind of talking through your story, it just made me think of, you know, what was some of the pivotal moments in my life where, you know, because as you get older, you kind of reflect back, don't you, a lot on experiences you've had and, you know, regrets and successes and all of that. But I think for me, probably the one of the most pivotal parts of my journey was back in 2018. I was invited to speak at the 100th anniversary of the closing of Carlisle Indian School in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. And I remember visiting there, and that for me was such an impactful visit, because you were seeing in the documented in the archives these exact same stories that we're navigating of survivance and resistance, right? You know, trying to survive in these really uncomfortable and complicated spaces.
And these little kids, they're just
babies. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that theme continues through you know, multiple generations as we talk about the ripple effects of trauma and intergenerational trauma. But yeah, and I think it's just so refreshing to listen to your story and to hear, you know, the obstacles and adversity and that you've had to overcome and the calling, you know, ancestors have a way of calling us back.
Oh my.
In a very beautiful, but sometimes difficult way. And that, you know, friction, I think, really is the space that creates the refinement. You know, it's a lifelong journey and it's a beautiful life. And I look forward to what the future has to hold for both of us.
Thank you.
This has been Not Invisible, Native Peoples on the Front Lines, a House on Fire production. Our conversation with Paulette continues on the Aunties Dandelion podcast. Follow them on Instagram at the Aunties Dandelion for episode links and more. And be sure to check out our show notes for links and more information. This episode is produced by Victor Mako, Spirit Buffalo, and JB Hart. Our editor is Abby Franz. Our theme song is Another Side by Wild Whispers, produced by Ben Reno, Eli Lev, and Megan Lee. This season of Not Invisible is produced with support from Earth Rising Foundation, our Patreon producers Kathy Doerr and Rena Krishnan, and our friends at Buy Me a Coffee. We'd like to give a special shout out to all of our Patreon supporters. You too can become a patron by finding us at Red House Series on Patreon or Buy Us a Coffee. Links on our website at redhouseseries.com. Wangide Weebdaha, I thank you all.